listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM. This is Writers' Voices, and I'm Chemaine Montana, hosting for Monica Hadley. And with me is our regular co-host, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Caroline.
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone's staying dry.
Yes. It's a challenge.
It's a challenge. I noticed the fields on the way over. I really have sympathy for the farmers because a lot of them didn't have their corn in yet, and it's going to be a while. Mm. So we have someone who's very our guest today is very acquainted with agriculture.
Mm-hmm. We have today Linda Eganes, author of Visits with the Amish: Impressions of the Plain Life. Linda Eganes is an adjunct faculty member at Maharishi University of Management. She's written about the Amish for Cobblestone, Plain, The Iowa Source, and The Plain Reader. She's been a contributing author to several other books, I noticed, when mm-hmm. I Googled you. And Linda Eganes visited with her Old Order Amish neighbors in southeast Iowa for 13 years before she wrote about them in this informative and heartwarming book, Visits with the Amish. So welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
Nice to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So tell us about this book. Why did you decide to write it?
Well, I kind of started writing the book kind of by accident, really. I was a student at Maharishi University of Management and a writing student in professional writing, at MA in professional writing. And one of our assignments was to write a query letter every month. Once a month, we had to write a query to a magazine, like pitching an idea to a magazine. And then if they said yes, then we would write the article. But we had to get that letter out. And, of course, it was the night before. I was waiting till the last minute, and I was thumbing through my guide to all the magazines, you know, Writer's Market, it's called, and thinking, oh, what could I write about? And then all of a sudden, I kind of landed in the section for the trade magazines, Roofer Magazine. And I remembered that there was this Amish construction crew that was putting up roofs on what we call the fraternity buildings on campus, these really huge dormitory buildings. They would do the whole thing in one day, you know, like a barn raising, this Amish construction crew, and they'd have their straw hats and their suspenders and their broadfall pants, a very traditional dress, and working together very quietly but efficiently, just like, you know, you see in the movies or something of a barn raising. And so I thought, oh, I'll write about that. Well, so I wrote to them, and they wrote back, and they said, well, it just happens to be the 200th anniversary of the roofing profession in America, and we want to make your story the cover story.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was my first publication, and, of course, I got teased terribly by my classmates, you know, who are writing for, I don't know, Family Circle and, I don't know, some travel magazines or something, and I was writing for Roofer Magazine. But but it was great because I got to meet the foreman of the crew, got to know him, Monroe Hirschberger. And he invited me out to his farm to visit. So I went with some classmates out to the farm in Bloomfield. That was back in 1985, actually. And met his family and his wife and children. And just that's how it started. Then I started writing for it for the Iowa Source and then Cobblestone Magazine. And then one thing led to another. Someone read that. They wanted to me to be the children's editor for Plain Magazine. And it just kind of took off.
Wow.
Well, that first thing, that supportive nature or what, huh?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I had my guardian angels there helping
me.
You betcha.
Are they pretty open to students and other writers coming to talk with them?
Well, it depends. You know, Monroe Hirschberger, because he was working on our campus and kind of knew sort of our community, he felt comfortable with us. Like, they would always tell me that they really liked working here in Fairfield because they said, you know, well, their experience on campus anyway, they were saying, you know, people really treated them respectfully and people didn't, you know, swear a lot or something or drink mm-hmm. or, mm-hmm. you know, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. So they felt that
they felt more at home.
Yeah, they felt safe there and comfortable. And, you know, there was a friendliness. And so, but, you know, it really depends on the community. There are some communities I was just interviewed by the Fairfield Ledger, and the reporter there was telling me that where she's from and where she visits down in Missouri and southern Iowa, that there actually are, you know, communities where the women are not allowed to speak to outsiders. Mm. So it's different from community to community. The Bloomfield community, the Kelowna community, they're very open. And also then the people I met were through contacts or, you know, somehow I was pointed to the right people mm-hmm. and who were open. There would be people who maybe would be there with their arms crossed and just say, no, I don't want to, you know, I don't really
want to
talk.
Of course, there are people in every society that are shy and don't want to talk
That's right.
about themselves, you know.
That's right. And so you that's absolutely right. And that's something really to keep in mind when you're talking about the Amish. I'm not trying to represent all of them in my book, just the people I met. That's all. Just giving the experience that I had.
Sure.
As you were experiencing the communities, did you feel that there were some neighbors that maybe, for privacy's sake, wish you weren't doing
well,
what you were doing?
I don't know. You know, one thing is that I did have one family. See, what happened was that I wrote all of these in a for magazines, mainly for Plain magazine. The editor at Plain magazine was a Plain Quaker himself, and he was starting this new magazine about Plain people, for Plain people, and he saw my article in Cobblestone magazine, which was a children's magazine that I'd written about my day with the Amish, and he wrote to me and said, you know, would you like to be the children's editor? And then once I started writing, he said, you know, you should really do a different article on a different subject every issue. Like one's about milking, you know, like the farm animals, one's about cooking in the kitchen with the Amish people, one's about visiting a one-room school, another one story was about going to their church services. So each one was a quilting, different part, and I put them together as a book. Well, once they were, when they were in Plain magazine, that was easier because it had because it was all for Plain people, about Plain people. They felt really comfortable with that. And of course, I would always make sure that they felt comfortable because I was interviewing a lot of young people. And so I had to make sure that they were, you know, the parents had approved because these were minors. You know, I felt, you know, it was incumbent on me to get the permission of the parents. And especially because they were, you know, they're not the kind of people that stick up for themselves so much or anything. I felt especially that I needed to protect them, you know, to make sure that what I was writing was not going to impact them negatively.
Oh,
just
absolutely.
Because of that thing about their neighbors and that, because they're very, you know, kind of a closed community and they have their rules, and I didn't want to step on anyone's toes. So I had them read them over, and they would usually just correct really small things like, well, you know, it really wasn't 1.5 miles to the school. It was 1 mile, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, the letters that the girls wrote to you, they had a couple of corrections in there, which
were small, too. And those were important corrections because, you know, I had mixed up the terms bridle and halter, and they were showing me, and I'd forgotten a couple of the cows' names, you know, Honey Lou and Sunny Sue. So,
that was
it was very sweet.
That was cute.
But then, anyway, once I put it together as a book, I had to get permissions all over again because it was originally published with Iowa State University Press in 2000. It went out of print because they were bought out by a textbook publisher. Long story. Anyway, it went out of print a few years later, and so now it's been put back in print by the University of Iowa Press with a brand new cover, and I'm very thrilled about that.
Oh, good.
But anyway, they made me get permissions, and so at that point, one of the families did drop out. And the reason was that they didn't like the magazine. Once I had told them about the magazine, they said, fine, the Plain magazine. And then once they read it, they said they didn't like it and didn't want to be in it.
It was too worldly?
Something like that. I don't really know what their situation was, but they were the only ones who dropped out. And so, you know, of course, I didn't include them.
Sure.
You know, but
sure.
Great. So let's talk about you as a writer. What prior writing experience did you have?
Well, as I was saying, I did go to have a degree in professional writing. I had always wanted to be a writer, but I didn't really know how to do it. I didn't really understand that, you know, there was a job, like jobs you could do that you could get paid to write. I thought you had to sort of be a struggling artist and write a novel and, you know, and that kind of thing. So I was, you know, it was in 1985 that I took the professional writing program at MUM, Marshy University of Management. And that was really, you know, an eye-opener. That was wonderful because we had a different course on just all different kinds of writing, journalism, magazine writing, poetry, script writing, book writing, technical writing, which I didn't do very well in. So I didn't like that one as well. But anyway, so once I finished that program a year and a half, I kind of had a taste of all these different kinds of things, and so I kind of knew what I wanted to do. And so, you know, I did a lot of client work, like kind of corporate writing for newsletters and things for different organizations and companies in town, newsletters, advertising, you know, now websites, you know, so I still do a lot of that, a lot of website writing. And but then I also started to write books, nonfiction books. First, I collaborated with an MD, a medical doctor, Dr. Kumita Reddy, and I wrote some books called, like, For a Blissful Baby, which is about pregnancy and childbirth, alternative healthcare, mainly about Marshi Ayurveda and alternative healthcare system that you know, is natural. And so I was the writer. She was more the, you know, kind of the, had the credentials, but I did all the writing, really. And another book, Conquering Chronic Disease. And then I collaborated with my husband on some books, Stories from the Upanishads, which is from the ancient literature of India. And I think that's all. And then this book. So this was the one book that I did solo.
Mm-hmm. How did that feel?
Well, it was nice. I liked it. I like collaborating, too. I do like working with other writers, although I think probably in the future now I'm probably going to do more of my own books. I mean, I have a couple manuscripts that are still coming out that I wrote earlier, and now I'm working on some new things that are just my own.
So how did you get into the Amish community? I mean, or how did you get interested in the Amish community, I should say?
Well, you know, mainly from just meeting the family, Monroe Hirschberger and his family, when they were putting up the roofs on campus. And just once I was inside their homes, it was like, it was just so charming and such a different and unique experience. And then because one thing led to another, and I was asked then to write other articles, you know, I became the children's editor of Plain Magazine. They wanted me to write other articles. Then I had to kind of extend my, you know, my contacts. In fact, you know, I had met a couple people in Bloomfield, you know, through the Yoders, I mean, through Monroe Hirschberger, and also Irvin Gingrich, who was working here in a construction crew as well. So I met a new family, the Yoders, who I wrote about quite often in the book, and got to know them quite well, and that was wonderful because I went back 3 or 4 times and, you know, 5 times, and really got to know them as a family and just had some wonderful experiences riding in their buggies and horse and buggies and milking the cow, which was I was very bad at, of course.
That takes practice like anything else, you know.
Yes, and so, lovely, you know, they would sing while they were working or sing while they were doing the dishes, and I got to learn how to make some of their food, you know, without any electricity, you know, like peeling. They have these elaborate kind of machines, you know, like that peel apples and core them and
oh, those,
you know,
apple
slice
peelers
them.
Are cool.
A lot of people have those even in Fairfield.
Yeah.
But then they also have potato peelers you know, kind of interesting relationship with technology, which we can go into if you are interested. But anyway, in that they have machines, but just not run by electricity.
Well, when you have to feed 300 people for a wedding dinner, you have to have some
yes,
peeling potatoes.
That's right. That's right.
And there was that one family that you knew over a span of years.
Yes, that was the Yoder family from Bloomfield. And so I kind of got to see their children growing up, and that was fun. In fact, by the last time that I visited, one of the young girls had married and had her own, you know, her own farm, and had, you know, and the other girl was engaged, and the sisters, two sisters. When I first met them, they were only 16 and 17, so they were, you know, still at home. And so that was really fun, and to get to know them and to get to know the mother, and it was wonderful, you know, to sort of be part of their lives. And it was is a charming experience. It was like sometimes I felt almost euphoric, like, because being far away from electricity and also just the way they relate to you, they're not, like, interrupted by telephones or emails, or they're not distracted when they're talking to you. They're so focused on you. And human interaction is really, you know, something that they
it's almost important to them.
Yes, it's a form of entertainment for them to meet other people, but also it's kind of what they do really well. They're very good at conversing and talking to each other and really relating, and without machines kind of getting in the way.
Mm-hmm. Why is it they don't like to have their picture taken?
Well, that's part of their Bible injunction not to have false images of God. Mm-hmm. And so a photograph, they feel, is... And because man is made in the image of God, then they feel a photograph is, you know, would be in that category. So, but they kind of enjoy looking at photographs that other people take. One time I went to visit one of the women who was in the quilting chapter, Leona Peachy, up in Kelowna, Iowa. And she and her sister, who was a member of the Beachy Amish, who are more liberal and can have cars. Well, her sister had these photographs of quilts. They make quilts together, and they kind of had a business. Oh. And her sister had all the photographs, and they were showing me them. And I said, well, I thought you couldn't Have photographs. I said that to Leona, who's Amish. She said, well, but if someone else takes them, it's okay. And I found out, and later I kind of asked about that, and they said, well, we kind of like looking at them if someone else takes them, although they don't like it when people ask them to take them. But if they do it inadvertently without them knowing, sort of, sometimes they kind of get a kick out of it, you know, because they get to see what they look like in a way.
Of course, we have the settlement in Kelowna and then in Bloomfield.
Right.
And are there any other in Iowa?
Well, yes. There's in Hazleton, which is up near in Buchanan County, kind of east of Waterloo. That's the most conservative community, and I didn't try to visit there. I don't think I would be welcome there. They're very conservative. They broke off from the Kelowna community because they wanted to be more conservative. But, you know, we also have a big community just south of us in the Keosauqua area, mm-hmm. Milton Pulaski area, that's also called. And so there's they come up, a lot of the families, a couple of the families come up from the, for the farmers market, the Gingrich family, I think, who does the plants, and they have a greenhouse down there. They bring them up here mm-hmm. and serve at our and sell them at our farmers market in Fairfield. And then also now there's a community that has kind of broken off from the Kelowna community, because I think mainly they said because of not enough farmland, and they have started near Brighton.
Yeah, because my daughter lives in Brighton, and I have seen that, and they have a store.
Yes, they have a little store. It's not mm-hmm. open every day of the week, but it's kind of on the corner of Salinas Road, and if you take Salinas from Fairfield all the way to out there, it tees into another road, and it's right near that tee,
right.
A little south of the tee. And so, and there's about six families there, and they come to our farmers market, too.
I have a friend who loves their pies.
Oh, yes. Yeah, their pies. They have really good food. They really know how to cook, and they enjoy their food, and they're not afraid of using sugar.
Well, you know, I always say our bodies know what to do with sugar. They don't know what to do with chemicals.
Well, there you go. That's a good point.
So if I have a choice, I'll take the sugar.
Yeah, the Amish don't use so many chemicals. You know, they grow their gardens are organic. And,
yes, and they are. They look like they're weeded with tweezers.
Yeah, they are very, you know, they have that kind of orderliness, German orderliness.
They
definitely are. One time when I went to visit one of the families, they were all out there with their hose and in the garden together, and they said the weeds had gotten a little away from them, but it didn't look that way to me. It looked really pretty orderly. And they don't use mulch. They just hoe and keep the weeds down that way.
Well, they use the grass clippings at one time for the strawberries.
That's right. That's exactly right. When it must be an Amish tradition, as you said, you grew up near.
Well, my husband was born and raised in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Of course, that's big Amish country.
Right.
And then we lived there for about 10 years, and so I had Amish neighbors right across the street, and a lot of Mennonites as well.
Yes.
The Mennonites are allowed to have cars and telephones.
Right.
But they also have a strict dress code. And,
they can if they're old order Mennonites.
Yeah.
There are Mennonites that you can't tell the difference how
to
dress, but the old order Mennonite, right? But yes, the families that I visit in Bloomfield, they also put the grass clippings on the strawberries. So that's interesting. Way over in Iowa, I had the same farming tradition. But there are many Amish people who now have become certified organic. Actually, there was a man from Fairfield, Alex Green, who actually went up to Kelowna many meetings and just voluntarily helped the Amish become certified organic, because they were already growing
organic
food.
So
they are able now to command higher prices for their food. And, you know, the Amish really believe in taking care of the soil and replenishing the soil. They feel from the, they take their teaching from the Bible to ruin the land would be to be more sinful than a thief. And that they should leave the land better than what they found it. And that, you know, they don't own the land, they feel, that God owns the land. They're only the stewards of the land.
Well, when they, in your book, in one place, this Amish man had bought a farm. It was new to him. And he found that it had been heavily, had been used chemicals on it. So he had to try to reverse that.
Yes.
And start to use manure and so forth.
He said it took about 7 years.
Yeah,
because they have manure spreaders. They use, you know, because they have like old-fashioned kind of farms with a little bit of, you know, like an animals, all different kinds of animals, chickens and horses and cows and pigs and, you know, a little bit of everything. And so they use the manure for the land. In fact, someone asked an Amish man, I was reading, why didn't you take on tractors, like when they came available in the 1800s, early 1900s, sorry, and because they would help you farm. And he said, well, you know, tractors don't make manure. So, you know, they, and also another big reason is that the big tires compact the soil. And it's well known in Amish communities that if they buy from a non-Amish farmer, that it will take at least 3 years to aerate the soil again with their plows and their horses.
That's why they use the if the ones that do use tractors use the big metal wheels.
Just the tiny metal wheels, yeah, the thin metal wheels. They don't compact the soil, right. I know in Kelowna they do allow tractors, but they are not allowed to use pneumatic tires, which means the rubber part. So they just have these steel rims, and they're rather narrow. Yeah, so they don't compact the soil. That's right. So this is where I think, you know, the Amish are very clever and intelligent farmers in that they really want to take care of the land, and they rotate the crops also. This is a practice they started back in Europe when they were kind of pushed to the margins of society, discriminated against, and oftentimes not allowed to have any own any land except the marginal land by the mountains or something. So they were able to, they had to be really good farmers in order to just farm on that land at all and to replenish it. So they use a four or five-year rotational system where they'll have corn 1 year and then hay, oats, and barley, something like that, or alfalfa, sorry, and maybe corn 2 years. But they continually rotate the crops. They really don't believe in depleting the soil. You know, that would be a sin, they would feel.
They don't have they don't have the mega farms.
No,
thousands of acres.
250 acres is the average size of an Amish farm. But, you know, since the 1980s and the farm crisis in the Midwest, especially here in Iowa, the Amish have felt, you know, had a lot of economic pressure, just like all small farmers in Iowa.
Sure.
It's difficult to really make a living on a small farm anymore. So they, you know, the Amish often have other jobs too. Like a lot of the families I visited, they will make pallets, like those kind of little wooden platforms that are used in factories to stack things on, or some kind of woodworking or workshop making dog houses or sheds, something like that. So they almost all have extra jobs. They try to find something that they can do on the farm. In some areas, though, they actually like in Ohio and Indiana, they're working more like in factories nearby because, you know, those jobs are available. But here in Iowa, they try to find a job that they can do on the farm to supplement their farming income. And it's not easy, you know. It can be quite a challenge.
Yeah, especially now it's going to be even more of a challenge because, you know, those jobs are some of the people aren't able to buy things.
Yeah,
that they're
with the economy slowing.
Yeah.
Surely.
Yeah.
You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM. This is Writer's Voices, and we're talking today with Linda Eganes, author of Visits with the Amish. How long did you work on the book?
Well, you know, it's funny, but I wasn't really working on a book originally. I was just writing these articles, but from the time that I started writing the articles in 1985 or 86, then on to 2000, when the book was actually published, that you could say I was sort of working on it for 15 years. But I didn't even know it was a book at that time. It kind of really, I only worked on it for about a year to pull it all together, all the articles that had already been published, to pull them together, probably about a year.
And I wanted to ask how you decided on the perspective in your writing. I noticed that you say, I sit rather than I sat.
Oh, yeah. I guess I was using present tense. I guess I just wanted to make it more immediate.
Mm-hmm.
My editor at Plain Magazine, Scott Savage, he felt that I had, he always would say, you have kind of a zen-like, you know, lens that you're seeing through. It's like we're seeing through your eyes, but yet it's kind of, you're not getting the writer's ego or the writer's voice is not getting in the way. So it was kind of first person in a lot of ways, but in some ways I didn't really want I wasn't like Sue Bender's book, which is Plain and Simple about the Amish, where it was like her own journey, or Mary Swander's books, which I love, you know, I love both those books. I love Sue Bender's and Mary Swander's books, you know, Out of This World, which was really about her own journey of healing.
Right.
This book was not really about me. It was really just I wanted to just give the experience, what experience I had. I wanted to give the readers the same experience I had being with these people and give the feeling of being with them and just the kind of soft and sweet and really loving and also kind of almost a euphoric feeling of being away from, you know, the pressures of modern life.
Well, it really did come through in the
good.
Book.
Oh, good.
You know, you're talking about the in one place, the harness, and you have some pictures of harness. That looks difficult to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you what.
It's complicated, doesn't it?
My neighbor in Lancaster, well, actually it was the gal who cleaned for me, said that sometimes when they have their singings, the young people, some ornery ones, would go out and switch all the harnesses around. And
yeah,
then they would try to get them all, and, you know, then they have to get them all.
They had to sort them all out.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
That was a favorite trick, apparently.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing also that I found about the Amish is that, you know, I was expecting them to be kind of sour, dour, just kind of serious, more like, because when you see them, the dark clothing.
Right.
Or just the way they wave to you in the highway, they're very solemn. But once you get inside their homes and their families and they're kind of in their inner circle, you find out that, you know, they're just like people everywhere, and some are more outgoing and some are less. But as a whole, I think they're really quite social, and just because it's the main form of their entertainment to be with other people. And they also tease a lot and joke a lot. They teased me, you know, and kind of like a big families anywhere might tease each other. And so this kind of, and playing jokes on each other, you know, like switching the harnesses and stuff, that would be, you know, I can really relate to that. From what I saw.
Mm-hmm. I love how you included specific song lyrics, recipes, instructions for making harnesses, for playing the children's games, quilting, things like that. Did you have in mind to do that in the beginning, or was that part of the articles?
I'm trying to remember.
Originally published?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to remember. I think the recipes were, but I think actually as I went along, and I think maybe like that quilting thing, but like the letters from the girls, I'm not sure I put those in the original articles. Mm-hmm. So when I was making the book, it's a pretty small book. It's only, you know, it's a little over 100 pages. But so I think I was trying to fill it out and make it more full and kind of, you know, when you're writing magazine articles, you usually have word count, you know, that you have to stick to.
Right.
And that's always hard for me.
I tend to
write a little longer. So I don't think I had as much, I'm quite positive, I didn't have as much material in the articles. I really filled it out. So that was kind of fun as a book. Also, I had to try to somehow put it together as a whole. And so that's why I added these sections at the beginning where part in italics where I explain different aspects of Amish life, like
mm-hmm.
what about the food or the cooking.
Was helpful.
And so I think I added a lot, and it just kind of mm-hmm. became richer, and that was fun. And I also went back to my notes when I was writing the book. I went back to my original notes and added things that I couldn't put in the articles because of space restraints. Mm-hmm.
The book is illustrated with woodcuts by Mary Azarian.
Azarian, yes.
They're just beautiful. Did she do the cover also?
Yes. Well, she didn't do the design of the cover, but this is they put a new cover on the University of Iowa Press. Just put this new cover on, which I think is just beautiful.
It is. Mm-hmm.
And they took one of her woodcuts and then kind of superimposed another one on top of it. That's kind of ghosted, as you can see at the bottom here. So it's very beautiful, but it's from her woodcuts. Yeah, Mary Azarian. This was another really fortunate thing about this book. She was a contributor to the Plain magazine as well. So when it came time for me to, do my book, I didn't really want to use photographs because, you know, the Amish don't believe in having their photographs taken. So mm-hmm. I wanted to honor them in every way and really represent them as they are. So my editor, Scott Savage, said, why don't you ask Mary Azarian? I bet she would, you know, let you use some of her woodcuts. So I wrote to her, and she just charged me something like $25 a woodcut to put it in. When you do a nonfiction book for a university press, anyway, you have to supply your own, you know, your own illustrations and that. So this was something affordable for me, and was an incredibly generous kind of thing for her to do.
Yes.
These were not original. She didn't make them original for the book. They weren't original woodcuts made for this book, but they were you know, ones that she had the copyright to. And so we sat together in the at Iowa State University Press, the editor and the art director and myself, and we all sat in this big table, and we had this big stack of photocopies of prints that she said we could use, and woodcut prints. And we just went through the stories, and we tried to match something to them. You know, we just had to find something that worked. Yeah. And I remember at one point we were like, oh, no, it's not going to work. We couldn't make a couple of the chapters work. But then we had the idea of taking sections of, like, the, I think it was the school chapter where it had the little alphabet board, and we took that section. Mm-hmm. And Mary Zarian was also really kind to let us do that, take a section of her woodcut. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what was really wonderful was that right after this book, she sold them to me, then she won the Caldecott Medal, which is the highest award for children's illustration.
Wow.
for the book Snowflake Bentley, which was a book by an Iowa author as well, Jacqueline Briggs Martin. So there's some kind of Iowa-Vermont connection here. Marian Zarian's from Vermont, so there's some connection between her and Iowa authors. But anyway, so I feel so honored that she, you know, that I have her illustrations in my book.
So no, it really adds a lot.
Yes.
It does.
Thank you.
Well, where can someone pick up a copy of Visits with the Amish?
Well, you can buy it at local bookstores, 21st Century Bookstore, also Revelations has it, Revelations Used Bookstore. And also I'll be giving a book talk and signing on Monday night at the Fairfield Public Library. That'll be at 7 o'clock, although you can come a little later if that's too early for you. It's kind of informal. I'll be talking about what the Amish can teach us about going green and saving money, because I think these are current topics that the Amish really have a lot to offer us, in our current economic situation. And we're going to be serving Amish apple brownies, too. So.
Oh, my goodness.
Bring food.
I hope you can come.
Yeah.
That's great. Have you done other book signings?
Yes. When the book first came out in 2000, I did quite a few around the state, different libraries and different places sponsored, would advertise. And I come arrive, excuse me, and I'd arrive and there'd be like 40 or 50 people. That was wonderful. And then I just did a book talk in Vero Beach, Florida, where we were for the winter. And I really didn't know what to expect. It was in an independent bookstore there, a lovely book called the Book Center, Vero Beach Book Center. And I didn't know if people in Florida would be interested in the Amish or not, but like about 70 people came to that talk. So that was a wonderful experience. So I'm really hoping that in Fairfield this time there's a huge, big... I did talk at the Fairfield Public Library in the past, too, at the Women's Night Inn. I don't know if any of you ever attended that. It was a wonderful group of about 40 women, and that was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So. Do you have any interesting stories of feedback you've received or interesting questions you've been asked?
Well, yeah, it is interesting. You know, people have different reactions. So I think one of the nicest things someone said to me about the book was that when they were reading it, they said they felt like they just started, even like kind of their heartbeat got slower and their breath got slower, and they just kind of settled down and relaxed, and they started to feel like they were kind of living this kind of a lifestyle, and they had that kind of a feeling. And I thought that was a wonderful compliment to give that experience through reading the book, because that was, of course, my aim, is to give the experience that I had. So that was a wonderful, I like that kind of feedback. And other people sometimes it's interesting, because sometimes you'll meet someone who's a former, who used to be an Amish person, or who's a Mennonite, or like sometimes in my book talks, often actually there'll be a former Amish person, someone who grew up Amish but hasn't chosen to remain Amish. And that's always interesting, just hear their reaction. Did they think it was true to life or that? And usually I've passed the test, I think, so.
Okay, let's dwell on that a moment. You say that the Amish community is actually growing or holding its own.
Yes. There's about 150,000 now, I think, in the United States, Amish people, scattered throughout the Midwest, of course, Lancaster County. The largest community is in Ohio, in Holmes County, Ohio. The largest community west of the Mississippi is Kelowna, Iowa. And since I wrote this book, there are actually a number of new communities, like over near Cheriton, I think that's how you say it, in Centerville, west of here. There's quite a few Amish communities in that area, another one in the north that I heard it just started. So there's a lot, and then, of course, the one we just talked about in Pleasant Plain. There's a lot of communities just springing up in Iowa alone, and a lot of people coming down from, from what I understand, there are people coming from, like, say, Minnesota. There's no more farmland there that they can afford, so they come down to Iowa. I met a family who did that and created a beautiful horse farm over in Bloomfield, and a in the place called Yoder's Country Corner. A whole group of, like, about four brothers came down, and beautiful place, a beautiful store. If you ever can get over there, it's a gorgeous store made of pine, whole pine logs and things, and made by their construction company. One brother does horses, another one does a construction company, another one does the mother had their quilts there, another one does builds things that like birdhouses and things that were sold in the store. So they had it was a whole family enterprise, and it's really a lovely place to visit. But anyway, so they say that, it's expanding because they have big families, 8 to 10 to 12 children, and average 8. And then, although some of them choose to leave the faith and leave the community, they say about 80% stay. So with those kind of statistics, it is growing, definitely.
Now, there's some tradition that the young people, the young men, can partake in. What is that called?
Rumspringa.
Rumspringa.
Yeah.
That's when they can have cars. They do in Lancaster County.
Mm.
They have cars and so forth and get it out of their system, as the older Amish say.
Yeah.
And then if they're ready to be baptized and come into the Amish community,
right.
Then.
Right. The Amish are Anabaptist, which means that they are not baptized at birth. They're baptized after, at the age 18, because they feel it's a very serious commitment to become an Amish person.
Right.
Because,
it is, obviously.
Yes, obviously you take these vows, and they're vows for life. So they want the children to be grown up and adults before they make that. So at age 16 or so, the teenagers enter what's called Rumspringa, or German for running around, literally. So they have their buggy, first horse and buggy. Now, in Lancaster County, as you were saying, maybe they actually can get cars or something. Maybe not while they're living at home, or they hide the car.
They hide the car.
Behind the garage. I mean, behind the barn or something. Or they're, out in the fields or somewhere.
Or they leave it at a gas station or something.
Or another place.
But see, Lancaster County is different because of the tourism.
Right.
And
right.
The Amish are under the microscope all the time.
Right.
It's a whole different thing.
Yes, right. In Iowa, it's these rural populations. They aren't near an urban center so much. But whereas in Lancaster County, because of the tourists and kind of being surrounded by the town, the Amish community is now surrounded by other, non-Amish, and also the same in Holmes County, Ohio. There's a lot of urban growth all around them.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot more opportunities for the Amish children to try out the worldly way. Ways while they're in the Rumspringa period. Here in Iowa, I think it's a little bit milder
kind of thing,
where they might put a radio in their buggy, or they might change their clothes and go to a movie downtown, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Who knows? They may be drinking parties, those kind of things. Definitely, there was a movie that came out a while ago called Devil's Play, The Devil's Playground, which is what, the Amish might call our world. And, it was about the kind of things that some of the Amish teenagers can get involved in these more populated Eastern communities.
I'm
and it
sure.
can be quite... quite troubling for the parents, because the children might even leave home for a couple of years to try out Western ways, which, can involve drinking and drugs and, sexual relationships. And it's kind of, it's sad in some ways, because these Amish children grew up a very sheltered life. They may not know how to handle.
They're naive about these things.
Naive,
yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's, kind of a big problem, because they aren't educated how to handle these kind of things.
Yeah.
So, but the interesting thing is that even so, 80% or so of those children, decide to come back to the faith, and, they maybe try it out, and then they, decide really what they want for their life, for their marriage, and for their children is, to be in the Amish way of life. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a young man, before he's married, he does not have a beard. They do not wear mustaches, but after he's married, then he starts to grow a beard.
Right. They have all these different rules. They don't wear mustaches, because in Europe and
the army
soldiers wore mustaches
yes.
And they are conscientious objectors and don't serve in the army. And so they don't want to look like anyone in the army. So.
And that's the reason they use straight pins instead of buttons as well.
Right. You know a lot.
Well, as I say, I lived in Lancaster County for 10 years. So, yeah. But I always admired the Amish and the ones that I knew, and their work ethic. And, everything. They're just great people.
Yes. It's a lot to be admired there.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, and we're talking to Linda Eganes, author of Visits with the Amish. And Linda's going to be at the library, let's mention that again, on Monday, this coming Monday, at 7 o'clock. And she will be, tell us again what you're going to be
talking Monday
about.
That's Monday the 18th. And so we'll be I'll be talking about what the Amish can teach us about going green and saving money. And we'll be serving Amish apple brownies. And just come whenever you can. If you can't make it there by 7, then come in later. We're happy to have you.
That's great. You know, my experience reading it was like the one person that you talked about feeling that perhaps that my heart rate was slowing, but it reminded me of times when I've been unplugged, times when I've lived in a tent long term, or I recently moved back to Fairfield and I didn't have internet or phone for 2 or 3 weeks, and it was so unplugged. And there's trade-offs in everything, you know, and I have to say that whenever I get in a situation like that where I'm unplugged, it does feel like interacting with reality somehow, with real life, people, not just ideas and symbols on your computer, but real life.
Right, right. In some ways, it's a more human existence. And I guess that's kind of what I experienced with the Amish, is that they are making decisions for their lives that are more in favor of the children, the family, maintaining a nourishing environment for older people. You know, like with their children. Well, there's a story like that an Amish man, David Wagler, who is actually lives in Bloomfield and is quite a famous author among the Amish community, and he has his own publishing company as well. And he was talking to a group of non-Amish parents, and he said, you know, how many of you believe in that that TV might be harmful for your kids? And almost every parent raised their hand. And then he said, well, now, okay, then how many of you are willing to give up TV in order to protect your children? And, you know, so that's kind of, in a way, that kind of shows the difference in the Amish life, that they will actually put into practice, even though it's hard in some ways, and it requires a lot of sacrifice in terms of, you know, really separating themselves from the world, but they do put into practice what they believe, and what they believe is best for them, their children, their community, and their faith, and to follow their faith. Of course, a lot of the things are faith-based, their decisions. But a lot of their decisions are also community-based. For instance, I asked one, Monroe Hirschberger, I think it was, the foreman of the crew that when I first met the Amish construction crew on campus, I asked him, why don't you drive cars? And I was expecting something about the biblical, you know, something. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if we drove out of town to purchase our goods, then the merchants, our local merchants, would be out of a job. So that just kind of shows in a way that they are understanding the way that we are interdependent in a small community, in a rural community. We are very interdependent. Here in Fairfield, you know, we need to support our local merchants, our local restaurants, and we need to buy local, because when we circulate our dollars locally, then it comes back to us in a way. It nourishes our community. Mm-hmm. It keeps our storefronts open. It keeps our property taxes stable. It keeps our houses from being sold and children from moving out of town. All those things keeps our town vibrant, and we all need to participate in our communities if we want to have a vibrant rural community as we do here in Fairfield. So you know, I think that they really are thinking of these things. They're thinking of the impact. What kind of impact is it going to have?
And they say, this one gal said, well, we don't miss what we've never had.
Yeah, that's a point.
You know, it's like me and coffee. I never drank coffee, so I don't miss it. People say, you don't drink coffee? No,
yeah,
I don't drink coffee.
So they don't miss TV because they never had it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, I've always identified myself as kind of a hippie back to the lander. And when I was younger and more idealistic, I planned to cook on a wood cook stove and the whole nine yards. And so I read about Amish people with great interest. And it was a revelation to me when I read that they're not meaning to be anachronistic, to do things the old ways just for the sake of the old ways, but that the leaders of a community will consider new technologies and ask themselves, what effect will this have on the community? Mm-hmm. So if a technology makes us less interdependent or makes us interact less, then that's not good. if all the women had sewing machines, they'd make quilts in their own homes instead of coming together to make quilts, and that's of a high value.
I found that extremely interesting when that gentleman took apart a standard sewing machine, made it into a treadle, but it still had some of the features.
That was so funny. Yeah, when I first went to Monroe Hershberger's home, and his wife Mary was showing me, you know, this beautiful sewing machine, new Kenmore sewing machine with a buttonholer, zigzag, everything. And then Monroe lifted it up, and underneath there was no motor because he had converted it to a treadle machine because they didn't have electricity to run it. And that was so funny. But, there's kind of this whole interesting relationship they have with technology. But but as far as sewing machines, I think most women the Amish women do actually have sewing machines because they sew their own clothes. But with the quiltings, what they do is that they get together, they will have pieced the pieces already together, like so it's one cloth. They will have done that on their sewing machines. But then they will put them on the frames
and quilt them
and stitch them by hand. So they won't do the stitching with the sewing machine. That will be done by hand, and they can fit like. They're so good at the quilting, they can get like seven stitches on one needle, on the needle at one time. And so in these groups of women all around the quilting frames, they maybe can finish two or three quilts in one day.
That's amazing.
At a quilting I was at in Kelowna above Stringtown Grocery. You may have been there in Stringtown Grocery. It's right off Highway 1 in Kelowna near the cheese factory. If you turn right there, there's a grocery store, an Amish grocery store, and above there's a meeting room which they have for auctions and also for quiltings. And then what they do with these quilts is they send them to the Mennonite Relief Fund, and it's sent all over the world. Like these quilts, particular quilts, were going to Haiti, they said, not for warmth, but for them to be able to put people to be able to put on the ground to sit on. But other quilts at the time were going to Romania and poor places in poor countries in Europe where they were used, to keep them warm at night. So they, the Amish are always, almost every Amish community that I visited had a monthly quilting in order to make quilts for relief, So
that's great. The value of service even to outside the community.
Yes. And there's also a Mennonite Relief Fund, which many Mennonites and Amish, it's a relief organization that many Mennonites and Amish will go to disaster areas within the United States, like, say, after a hurricane, and go and help rebuild because they have the building skills. And so they would go in van loads and go and stay with the families. Like I talked to a woman in South Carolina, after Hurricane Hugo. She said that, the trees were all topped in her area. And she said it was a terrifying experience being in the storm. And then, so many different homes were decimated. So she said this Amish family came and lived with them. And they rebuilt their home, and they played with the children. The women would play with the children, the men would build, and the women would cook. And she said it was just so calming and such a wonderful thing to have this Amish family there helping them after this disaster. And so that's the kind of thing too that they do. So
you talked about that there are about 50 last names in the Amish community.
Yes, there's not a big gene pool. So this is a problem. This is probably one of the bigger drawbacks. Well, there are many drawbacks to Amish life. I'm not trying to say that, this is the ideal thing or that I want to be Amish, but I think we can learn from them.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying. But in terms of the gene pool, there is, a problem with that because there's a lot of intermarriage, especially in the larger communities such as in Lancaster County and Holmes County, because they'll meet someone within the community and they marry. And they may actually be connected on both sides of the family tree. So they could be like second cousins on both sides or something like that. They won't marry first cousin, but even second cousins. And so this leads to some genetic disease and more of a prevalence of that. So, obviously that's something that the leaders really need to take charge of and educate them, because as it is now, what they generally feel is if the child is born to their family who has special needs, they feel it's a gift from God, a way to show their compassion, and they're very compassionate towards anyone who is handicapped, but still it's, obviously from our perspective, we would think it would be better to prevent, problems like this.
Well, marriages are not arranged because they're free to choose their own husband or wife, they're limited in who they can meet because,
That's right.
When you travel by horse and buggy, you don't always
That's right. Although they can meet at weddings, like they may get in a van as a family and go across the country for a wedding.
Right.
And that's often where, especially people from smaller communities, meet other young men and women. So,
mm-hmm.
Did you get any insight as to why they're not a proselyting church?
Well, yes. This was a point I was. I don't know if I how did you,
you
know that? Did
it.
I mention that?
Yeah,
in the
you
book?
Did. You
did I mention that,
that
in the book? Yeah. Well, this was something that was, you know, nice for me in that they weren't. Whenever I talked to, you know, these families, it was just two people getting to, or it was just human-to-human interaction. It was just because we enjoyed being together, and also because I was gathering information for my book. But they were never trying to convince me that Amish life was better, or in fact, they really don't especially want other people to become Amish. They just, you know, they really just want to have the liberty to live their life here free from persecution, which is why they came here to the United States from Europe, because they were persecuted there. But I don't really know why they basically, I don't know, it must go back to their roots in I don't know the answer to that question, why they don't proselytize or why they don't want to convert others. They don't. It is possible to become Amish. In my book, I talked about one family that had been Catholic, and then they became Mennonite, and then they became Amish, and they were quite happy doing that. But but that was like a New Order Amish community too that they were part of. So I'm not sure really how you would become Old Order Amish. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody has done that. Maybe possibly.
Yeah, you say here. The Old Order Amish do not believe in missionary activity or persuading others to join their faith. While they aspire to be a light unto the world, they are exhorted to provide an example to Amish youth through their actions. They do not expect or even desire outsiders to join them.
Yeah. Go. Oh, thank you.
you also say that their philosophy is to be in the world but not of it.
That's right. And that's kind of why they are separate from the world. They remain separate. They're here to live a spiritual life, and their particular kind of spiritual
life. I think it's wonderful that the government lets them have their own schools. I really do. I mean, to me, that's a real. I mean, you know, then they're able to keep their way of life.
Yes, this actually was an important point. That around the 1960s, what happened was that the Amish were, you know, would have their children go to other rural schools along with other rural children, non-Amish rural children, when there were, you know, rural schools scattered all over the farmlands,
right.
One-room schools pretty much, or two-room. But then what happened in the 60s, that there was a move toward consolidation. So then children were put on school buses and bused to a nearby town where they would come from all miles around to one school where it would be larger.
Right.
So the Amish really balked at that. They didn't want their kids getting into school buses and going out of the community. They wanted their children close by. So they would keep their children at home. The truant officers came after them. They would arrest the parents. The children would run from the truant officers. They'd run from the school buses. It was a huge kind of upheaval.
Controversy, I'll bet.
And controversy. So finally, it went to the Supreme Court in the 1960s, and it was ruled that because of their religious beliefs, the Amish could have their own parochial schools, and that they could stop educating their children sending them to school at eighth grade, because they could educate them at home, the boys with their father and the girls with their mother, to learn the Amish way of life. And that's what the Amish wanted to do. So this was, you know, sanctioned by the Supreme Court. And so now you have these like within a mile of every home, the schools are placed, the one-room schools are placed within a mile of every home. So the children can ride their pony carts. They can get in a pony cart and drive themselves to school and back, or they can walk. And so it kind of really is a relief for relief for the mothers. They don't have to drive their kids back and forth to school when they have 12 kids or so.
Yeah.
And it creates a lot more kind of silence and kind of leisureliness for the mother. And then also she has the teenage girls at home helping her, learning to cook and clean and garden and all the things that a woman would need to do in the Amish way of life. So, and having their own schools also made it possible for them to retain more of the youth in the within the community. Because when they met other people at school, they were exposed to other influences. But now, what they're kind of within their own insular school, the one-room school, and they don't meet other people so much, especially in these rural communities, like in Iowa, where there's not so many other people around. So some of the Amish people had told me that there's a higher retention rate within the Amish faith now that they have their own schools.
Would you like to grace us with a little reading? Just maybe 5 minutes?
Sure. So here, maybe we'll, let's see, why don't I read a little bit about cooking and the cooking in the Yoder's Country summer kitchen.
Good, good.
This is chapter 3. The Amish are famous for their cooking. While some recipes come from German and Swiss ancestors, many meals resemble traditional American farm fare. Meat, potatoes, homemade bread, garden vegetables, biscuits and gravy, and a baked dessert. The food varies slightly from region to region. For instance, shoofly pie made from molasses and eggs is a famous Amish dessert in Pennsylvania. But Annie and Regina Yoder's family from Bloomfield, Iowa, had never heard of it.
Oh my gosh.
Although they shun material comforts, the Amish do not skimp on food. Because most families work up an appetite laboring on the farm, they enjoy 3 large and tasty meals a day, starting with a robust hot breakfast. Homemade baked goods are an important part of the Amish diet. Fresh homemade bread appears at most meals, and cakes, pies, or cookies are never lacking. Food plays an important role in any Amish gathering, and each guest brings something to contribute to the meal. Since they believe in being as self-sufficient as possible, the Amish raise most food on their own farms. Fresh eggs from chickens, you know, like the kind of eggs that are still warm from the chickens.
Yeah.
Amazing. Milk from cows, vegetables from gardens, fruits from orchards, grains from the fields, and meat from farm animals. Even popcorn grows in the garden. It's common to see bundles of popcorn tied in white muslin hanging from the front porch eaves to dry. Amish gardens are vast, covering as much as 1 acre. While the women are usually in charge of the garden, often the whole family pitches in for weeding and planting. In the gardens I saw, the plants lined up in neat rows. Amish women usually plant plenty of bright-colored flowers to line the edges, like candace or those kind of tropical-looking flowers. In a typical Amish garden, not a weed shows its head. So to find out more about Amish cooking, I visited my friends Annie, Regina, and Grace Yoder. For some dishes, the Yoder girls follow recipes. For others, such as hash brown potatoes or salad dressing, they do it by guess. Should I keep reading, or...?
I think we might actually run out of time to read this section.
Okay. Well, that was just like the kind of the prelude to the chapter. The chapters actually have dialogue and are actually kind of scenes you're actually there when you're in it.
This little background before each chapter, just to give us a little setting of what's
going to happen.
Yeah. Really nice. And then you end up including the lyrics of the songs that they sing while washing the dishes.
That's really fun.
And a recipe for part of the dessert. That's wonderful. Friendship bread.
This is the kind of book that you can read just a chapter at a time, sit down and share it with a friend. It's just really a great book. It really is.
Thank you.
My favorite section was the one about the church service and the singing and how the men would... make a kind of drone, hold a note to make a drone.
That was incredible. I mean, it's really amazing because they don't even use a pitch pipe it's against their religion to use any instruments at all. So they don't even use the pitch pipe. And I think in some communities you might, but the person who leads, the young man who is sort of like a cantor who leads the singing, has to have perfect pitch. So he starts, and it is sort of like it's this low, long kind of singing. And then the women chime in, and they're fluty and high, and it's all weaving together, and it's so beautiful, mournful but joyous at the same time. And it takes about 15 minutes or so to get to down one page of music. And this is this ancient kind of songbook, like Gregorian chanting or something.
That surprised me, too, that they will go on for 20 minutes. One song.
Yeah, and
is very interesting.
Yeah, and just one page of the song, it could take 15 minutes. It's really amazingly slow.
Visits with the Amish by Linda
Eganes,
and you can get this book at 21st Century Books
or Monday, this Monday the 18th at the library for a book signing.
And book talk.
And book talk.
At 7 o'clock.
Come and meet the author. You will be delighted, I assure you.
Thank you so much for being with us, Linda. This has been thoroughly enjoyable.
Thank you, Shemaine and Caroline.
I got to say this last thing here. Don't let me, because this comes from the book.
Was
at the Amish school.
Our quote from Caroline.
Yeah, this is the Amish school. If you have something to say about someone else, you should say it as if they were listening.
I love
Good
that.
Good point.
I love that. Thank you so much, Linda.
Thank you.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.